طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we take a critical look at the Palestinian struggle through the eyes of civil rights icon Angela Davis, whose long support of the integration of various struggles for equal rights throughout the world is legendary. She's been an activist for Palestine for many years, and today she discusses that intersectionality with Frank Barrett, a French author, journalist, and film producer, who also has been a longtime supporter of Palestine. The conversation begins with Frank Barrett framing the conversation.
Welcome to Witnessing Palestine. This is show number 3. Between now and our last show, which was with Suzanne Aboulawa and Francesca Albanese, a lot of things have happened in Palestine. The Israel onslaught has continued. More people have died. More innocent civilians have died. More babies have died. More women have died. But something quite momentous happened also last Friday when the World Court, the International Court of Justice, found that there were actually grounds to believe that Israel's action in Gaza could amount to genocide, and therefore imposed provisional measures to try to stop it. To discuss this and much more, I am joined today by a truly amazing guest that needs no introduction, Angela Davis. Hello, Angela.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for inviting me to participate in your program.
It's a pleasure and it's an honor, you know, to speak to you again. It's been a while, so it's nice to see you again. I wanted to start by asking you, you know, every time I hear you talk or I heard you talk, every time I read something you've written, Palestine is present, you know, in your speeches, in your writing. We have experienced in the last 3 months something I wish no one would ever have to go through or to witness, pretty much the annihilation of a people live on our screens, which made it even worse, I guess, by the state of Israel. I spoke to Noura, that you also know very well, Noura Erekat, recently. Yes. And we talked about the fact that we really felt like these last 3 months were kind of a collective trauma, you know, of people, again, experiencing a genocide live. And I wanted to start in a way by asking you about Palestine in particular, to ask about, in a way, your own journey of understanding when it comes to Palestine. And I want to ask you, how important was your visit to Palestine in 2011?
Well, first of all, Frank, I should tell you that I've actually been reflecting on my own trajectory with respect to solidarity with Palestine. And you know, I've been remembering what it was like to attend a university which was founded in the same year as the State of Israel, what it was like to learn to experience solidarity with Palestinian people from my Jewish classmates at Brandeis, and thinking about the conversations, the sort of subterranean conversations that happened on the campus when the administration always emphasized the importance of Brandeis supporting the state of Israel. So I've had a very long journey has involved Palestinian political prisoners supporting me when I was in jail, that has involved meeting Arafat at the World Festival for Youth and Students in 1973, I believe it was, in East Germany. And I've come to realize that my own sense of myself as a political being is very much linked to the ways in which I've learned how to experience and organize for solidarity with Palestine. It seems to me that Palestine represents to this generation what South Africa represented to older generations. And the sense that it has to be incorporated into every social justice agenda, particularly now, given this genocidal assault on the people of Gaza. So on the one hand, I'm very sad, and I know that this is an emotional issue, not only a political issue for so many people around the world. But at the same time, I'm happy to witness a kind of massive show of support for people in Gaza, and to see people standing up to Zionism as they never have before in my own experience. And so my visit to Palestine in 2011 was really a kind of turning point for me. I had been involved in solidarity efforts for Palestine since my days in college. But it was visiting Palestine and recognizing that as much as I thought I knew about the situation of apartheid in South Africa, that I really didn't. And it brought forth memories of growing up in the most segregated city of the United States. It made me recognize that in so many respects, the situation that Israel has created for Palestinians was far worse than anything that I had ever experienced. And so those of us who went on that delegation, it was a delegation of women of color and indigenous women who were scholar activists. We all made a strong commitment that we would continue to do the work that we were doing, but even more so, to try to help guarantee that the question of Palestine was incorporated into social justice issues and social justice agendas, no matter what their particular focus. For too long, there were all of the social justice issues, movements against racism, movements for gender equality, movements against war in other parts of the world. And then there was Palestine as a separate issue. And so we made a commitment to ourselves and to the world to try to assist in breaking that isolation that had been responsible for the fact that so many people around the world, and especially here in the U.S., simply did not know what was happening in Palestine.
It's interesting to hear you say this, because that's exactly how I felt during my first visit in 2007. As much as I thought I knew, when I got there, it really radically changed everything. You know, I thought there was no turning point. And I remember reading Arundhati Roy, who said sometimes like you see it and you can't unsee it. And that's exactly how I felt after I came back. You know, it sort of radically changed everything in a way, the way I put Palestine in the midst of other struggles and things. So I wanted to ask you about a person as well, June Jordan. In 1982, June Jordan wrote a long poem that included, "I was born a black woman and now I become Palestinian." I was wondering how much influence she had in maybe inspiring African Americans and others to actually understand what Palestine truly was. And I was wondering if you, I guess, knew June Jordan.
Well, June was a very close friend. And she was a pioneer with respect to efforts to generate solidarity for Palestine. And that poem that you refer to, Moving Toward Home, is a really powerful expression of the need for solidarity, especially lines of solidarity linking Black people in the U.S. With Palestinians. Yes, in the 1980s, June was traveling to Lebanon in the aftermath of the war there. She was engaged in conversations with those who were still very much influenced by Zionism. Adrienne Rich, for example, who was a well-known a poet, had an extended engagement. Well, they became friends, but initially, June was very critical of Adrienne for failing to recognize the place of Palestine in our imagination. And so eventually, Adrienne became a very powerful representative of the need to challenge the state of Israel, to challenge the U.S. for its alliance with Israel, for being the most powerful ally that Israel is able to claim. I could talk about June forever, and I find myself during this period, and as a matter of fact, since the demonstrations in 2014 that took place in Ferguson, when we began to see a visible show of support for Palestine among young Black people with Dream Defenders, et cetera. So I find myself wishing that June were still here, because she is certainly responsible in many ways for this development of a sense of political kinship between Black communities in the U.S. and Palestinians who are struggling for their freedom. But that is an amazing poem. There's also the poem that is about the war in Lebanon. And it is, if one reads it, it reads like a description of what is happening in Gaza today.
Yeah, I think, you know, we all miss her and her writing, her poems, her influence. Again, it's interesting you saying that reading June's poem about Lebanon, you feel like it's what's happening in Gaza now. I recently found a video of yours at the Russell Tribunal. I think it was in 2014 at the last session in Brussels, where you gave one of the closing speech. And listening to the speech, you could put it today, change a few dates, and it's again exactly what's happening in Gaza now, maybe times 10, but the process, the pattern is actually exactly the same, which shows that again, history didn't start, you know, on October 7th, as you know.
Oh, absolutely. And there is there's a dimension of Zionism that refuses to recognize history, that has wanted to freeze history at a particular moment, so that even in 2024, when we're looking back at the events of last fall, we see that the discourse of the government and the discourse of the Zionist support for the government recreates the very history out of which the state of Israel was born. And I think that makes us, that causes us to be critical of the very process of establishing a state, a nation state, on the basis of preventing catastrophic assaults on humans, and seeing that state as the only possible answer to those catastrophes. Recognizing that the state relies on the military, it relies on violence, it relies on war, so that it means that the only way to really respond is through violence. I think I'm hoping this period will also inspire us to have different ways of imagining the future outside of the framework the nation state with its military and all of its police and its, you know, various forms of violence.
I guess an abolitionist perspective is needed now more than ever. I wanted to also ask you about something you often spoke about, Black internationalism. Recently, I was with a Palestine organization I'm working with, and talking about, you know, strategy and stuff, we realized that a lot of the work charities, organizations, NGOs working on Palestine do is very, you know, Euro-centered or Western-centered, right? We're trying to lobby our MPs in London, in the US, but when you hear about the response right now of the West, you realize, and when you see the response of the global South, the majority world, you realize that in a way we're wrong. We should build very strong alliances with the global South, with the majority world, because we cannot expect the people that actually are pulling the strings and are making Israel, you know, are allowing Israel to do what it does, to one day again give the privileges away and stop. So I was wondering if that's what you in a way meant by Black internationalism. And we spoke about this with Susan, actually, Abulhawa, a few days ago as well. The need for us to build alliances with the global South, which is the majority world.
Well, yeah, that's definitely important, particularly South-South alliances. I think the problem that you're referring to is the fact that there's been the assumption that all alliances need to be rooted through the global North. And so therefore, many of, you know, very productive engagements between people who live in the global South have been prevented. But I think that I'm reminded by your question of something that W.E.B. Du Bois pointed out many, many decades ago, when he talked about the best kind of Pan-Africanism, the best way to pursue a kind of Pan-Africanism, which many people at the time were thinking about only because of the racial kinship between Black people in the U.S., for example, and Black people in Africa. And Du Bois pointed out that it was not racial kinship that would produce the kind of internationalism and the kind of solidarity we needed, but rather recognizing that anti-imperialist efforts were at the very heart, or needed to be at the very heart, of those alliances. So not alliances formalistically based on some notion of race, but rather on very concrete solidarity and commitments of solidarity that would bring people of African descent together with people all over the world who were also struggling against anti-imperialism. But I think internationalism has always been an important dimension of Black struggles. As a matter of fact, when I think back to the period when people like Frederick Douglass traveled to Europe, and Ida B. Wells later during the anti-lynching movement, traveled abroad in order to garner support for that movement. In many ways, Black people in the U.S. always been the beneficiaries of international solidarity. Yeah. And there have been those who recognize that we not only should see ourselves as beneficiaries of solidarity, but also as forgers of solidarity for people around the world who are oppressed by capitalism, by racial capitalism, as a matter of fact, because if we talk about challenging racism, it has to express itself in an awareness of the role that capitalism has played in producing racism. And as many people have pointed out, the system of capitalism we know now is racial capitalism, and therefore without a dimension of internationalism, there's no possibility of even beginning to organize for its downfall.
In a way, in this regard, how important was it, in your opinion, that South Africa launched the case at the International Court of Justice against Israel?
First of all, I know many of us are still very emotionally connected to what we imagine a victory for South Africa would bring to the world. South Africa was our hope. Because of global capitalism, you know, the IMF and other, you know, capitalist financial centers, and because of, problems within South Africa, because of the kind of difficult internal difficulties, political, but also the ways in which a struggle never unfolds exactly as one imagines it. And so there's been a kind of depression, I think. We thought Brazil for a time would play the role that South Africa failed to play in the aftermath of the overturning of apartheid. And then what did we experience? So I'm saying all of this. I have this long preface to my remark that whatever the eventual outcome of the court decision, the fact that South Africa stood up to represent for Palestine has, I think, created new hope in the world. I think that those of us who felt that we had invested so much in the struggle against apartheid, and then we were, in a sense, let down. We can now look at South Africa and its alliance with Palestine on the world stage and say that it was worthwhile to engage in all of those years of struggle to dismantle apartheid. So I'm totally impressed with the work that South Africa has done. It I think is having an impact on people everywhere. A source of hope.
Could it be? I mean, could it be like, I mean, I'm trying to be maybe utopian, a rebellion of the global South, and in a way, the end of US hegemony. You know, the US has always, scared countries to act because they said, watch out, we're the boss. If you act, we'll cut this, we'll cut that. You know, South Africa took a risk and a lot of countries followed, you know, and said they're going to support it. So in an ideal world, could it be the beginning of the end for US hegemony?
Well, of course, that is our hope. The definitive end of U.S. hegemony is going to require a lot more struggle at many different levels. But I think this moment allows us to concretely glimpse a future in which the ideological whole of the U.S. Is not so powerful over so much of the world. The fact that the court made the ruling that it did, of course, you know, everyone was disappointed that we didn't get a ceasefire. But there are many reasons, of course, why that didn't happen. I think that that was, in many ways, the best possible outcome of, at least in relation to the preliminary report. And, you know, as all of us have been watching, what we regard as a genocide unfolding before our eyes, that to hear the president of the court read the ruling that incorporated so much of the language that South Africa had used, and the fact that the president of the court is from the United States, considering that the U.S. is the greatest ally of Israel, and the only judge who didn't sign was from Uganda, and I really don't understand that, especially since Uganda, whatever one might think about Uganda, disassociated itself from that judge's position. So this was a virtually unanimous decision, and I think that whatever legal impact it might have, the most important impact is going to be on other states and individuals around the world who now have a stronger framework to engage in the work that we need to be doing in order to bring an end to this genocidal war.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the ICJ, provisional measures were like, you know, when you've got a box of tools, you know, that you use during a struggle, this is a massive tool for us, for legal experts, also for citizens. So this is going to be very important. And it's not over. I mean, South Africa could ask for other provisional measures if Israel doesn't respect these ones. So it's an ongoing story. I want to end by asking you like one question into two or two questions into one. Arundhati Roy, her again, said in the middle of COVID, and you remember that, that COVID was a portal. I don't know if you remember when she said that. I was wondering, and that's not my question, but it's already a question. Do you think Palestine could be a portal? I mean, I'm going to answer it for you the way I think. For me, Palestine is a microcosm of everything that is wrong with the world in terms of racial capitalism, in terms of colonialism, in terms of genocidal policies and apartheid. But it's also through the work of many people through the hundreds of thousands of people that have stopped everything in the last 3 months to focus on Palestine, a portal into what could be the world, if you know what I mean, right? So that's part of my question. And you said actually a lot of time that Palestine for you was a moral litmus test for the world. So I was wondering what you meant by that. And if you agree that Palestine could be actually the portal that maybe South Africa wasn't, the post-apartheid South Africa.
Well, you know, Frank, as Stuart Hall said, there are never any guarantees. There are no guarantees, but it is important, and I like to say, to act as if it were possible to change the world, not only to imagine, but actually to bring into existence a moment in the history of the globe when exploitation and racism and war are not the primary features of human society. And, you know, I think that what I find so inspiring is that so many people, regardless of the particular efforts they are involved in, so many social justice activists have turned their attention to Palestine. You know, whether you're talking about feminist organizations, LGBTQ movements, abolitionist campaigns, climate activism, food justice movements. And we see this happening. We see this happening on the continent of Africa. We see it happening in Australia. We see it, you know, happening in South America. So I'm remembering a moment when I spoke in a rural area of Brazil as they were attempting to build a new university system that would admit Afro-Brazilians, people of African descent in Brazil. And I remember, you know, as you said, I always like to mention Palestine. And this was some years ago. And I mentioned how important it was to link our struggles with what was happening in Palestine. And the thousands of people who were present there just erupted into massive applause, which I did not expect. And so now when I see the images of vast numbers of people demonstrating in country after country after country, it reminds me that these connections across national borders are possible, that Palestine is allowing us to imagine a very different kind of world. We struggle for justice for Palestine, not because it is the moral thing to do, which it is, not because it is the only way in which we can imagine a future for people who live in that part of the world, which it is, but because it represents a capacity to build new lives and new dreams for people everywhere. And so I'm, you know, while I'm extremely sad to have to witness the damage and devastation that has been inflicted by Israel, who preface their war by referring to the defense minister, at least referring to Palestinians as human animals, I believe that awakens something in people everywhere, including, I'm hoping, increasingly among Jewish people inside Israel. The one thing that I should point out that has been so inspiring is the fact that young Jewish people have taken the lead. in this struggle, have called for and given leadership to demonstrations that are happening all over the U.S. It does make us dream of a world in which we will have eradicated racism and anti-Semitism and economic exploitation and gender violence. So yeah, we deposit our dreams, I think, in Palestine.
Thanks, Angela. What an amazing way to finish. I think, you know, again, you're entirely right. We need to believe in our dreams. Otherwise, you know, the who's going to struggle? You know, Howard Zinn said that, you know, the struggle needs to be exhilarating and in a way joyful and beautiful, because if it's not, you know, who else going to join? So I think, you know, despite the horror, we have to try to focus on the beauty to keep going. So again, thanks again, Angela. We'll speak soon. And a happy belated birthday. It's been three
days.
Thank you.
So. Thank you, Frank. Okay. And thank you for all that you do.
You have been listening to Angela Davis and Frank Barrett discuss the issues consuming Gaza. Before we go, I want to play a clip of Bernie Sanders running down the current situation in Gaza as only he can do.
Thanks very much for joining me. I want to take a few minutes to discuss something that is not being discussed adequately in the corporate media, nor in Congress. And that is that right now, today, in Gaza, we are witnessing one of the worst humanitarian disasters in modern history. It is unfolding before our very eyes, and we must not turn away from that reality. And I'm sorry to tell you what I think many of you already know, that we in the United States of America are deeply complicit in what is happening. What we do in Congress right now could well determine whether tens of thousands of people live or die. Let's briefly review what has happened in the last 4 months. On October 7th, Hamas launched a horrific terrorist attack that killed 1,200 innocent Israelis and took more than 230 hostages. More than 100 of those hostages are still being kept in captivity. That is what started this current war. And as I have said many times, Israel has the right to defend itself against Hamas terrorism. But it absolutely does not have the right to go to war against the entire Palestinian people. And that, tragically, is what we are seeing. As of today, Israel's military campaign has killed more than 27,000 Palestinians and injured some 68,000, two-thirds of whom are women and children. Unbelievably, 1.7 million people have been driven from their homes, nearly 80% of the population. This is more than twice the population of my own state of Vermont. These people have no understanding as to where they will be tomorrow or whether they will ever return back into their communities. The devastation caused by Israeli bombardments is unprecedented in modern history. Some 70% of the housing units have been damaged or destroyed. Can you imagine that? The Israeli bombing attacks have destroyed most of the infrastructure in Gaza. There is no electricity and very little water. There are virtually no places to buy bread and basic necessities, as most of the bakeries have been destroyed or shut down. Raw sewage is now running into the streets, and communications are extremely difficult because there is little or no cell phone service available. Despite the tens of thousands of Palestinians who have been injured, there are no fully functional hospitals in Gaza, and just one in three is operational at all. Amid repeated attacks on healthcare facilities, doctors and nurses are still bravely working to save lives, even without regular electricity or basic medical supplies. Israeli bombing and the onerous restrictions placed on aid entering Gaza mean that only a tiny fraction of the food, water, medicine, and fuel that is needed can get in to Gaza. And even when supplies do get across the border, very little of that can reach beyond the immediate area around the Rafah crossing near Egypt. Let's take a deep breath and understand what all of this means for the men, women, and children who are in Gaza today. Not only have they been driven from their homes, not only have most of those homes been destroyed or damaged, not only are they unable to access the medical care or the clean water they need, but unbelievably and horrifyingly, hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza face starvation. Let me repeat that. Hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza face starvation. The UN says that 1 in 10 children under the age of 5 in Gaza is already acutely malnourished, and the entire population is at imminent risk of famine. What every physician knows is that malnutrition in small children causes permanent physical and cognitive damage. In other words, even if the war ended today, large numbers of children in Gaza will suffer permanent physical damage from what has happened in Gaza. And that's not to mention the extraordinary psychological damage that these children will suffer from as they have witnessed all of the death and destruction around them. If nothing changes, we will soon have hundreds of thousands of children literally starving to death before our very eyes. And believe it or not, the situation could even get worse. Right now, 1.4 million people, more than half of the population of Gaza, are squeezed into the area around Rafah, right up against the Egyptian border. Rafah was a town of just 250,000 people before the war. Now there are 1.4 million people there, more than 5 times the original population. These people are packed into crowded UN shelters or sleeping out in tents. It's a daily struggle for them to find food or water. And in the midst of all of this horror and suffering, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, the leader of Israel's extreme right-wing government, has announced that Israel will soon launch a major ground offensive against Rafah, where 1.4 million people are located. What that means is Netanyahu will soon be forcing these desperate people to evacuate once again, and nobody has any idea as to where they will go. These families, already exhausted, traumatized, and hungry, will once again be displaced with no plan for how they will survive. I struggle to find words to describe this cruelty. And let me state once again that much of what is happening in Gaza now is funded by U.S. taxpayers. These are our bombs and our military equipment that is being used. We are complicit. This is not only an Israeli war, this is an American war. Prime Minister Netanyahu says that all of this is necessary. He says that Israel will only accept quote-unquote total victory in this war. Yet asked recently what total victory would look like, he chillingly said that it is like smashing glass, quote, into small pieces, and then you continue to smash it into even smaller pieces, and you continue hitting them, end of quote. The question we must ask ourselves over and over again is how many more children and innocent people will be smashed in the process? And why is the United States helping to fund this humanitarian disaster? It is quite clear that beyond total destruction of Gaza, Netanyahu has no plan. This week, President Biden acknowledged the severity of this crisis. He said that Israel's response in Gaza, quote, has been over the top, end quote, and added that, quote, there are a lot of innocent people who are starving. There are a lot of innocent people who are in trouble and dying, and it's got to stop, end quote. That's President Biden. Well, he is absolutely right. It does have to stop. Then why in God's name are we now contemplating legislation that provides $10 billion more to the Israeli war machine to continue funding Netanyahu's war? President Biden and Secretary Blinken have been trying to negotiate an agreement where Israel pauses its military operation, Hamas releases the remaining hostages, and massive humanitarian aid comes in to help desperate people. We all hope that this deal comes together. But Netanyahu is resisting this proposal. In my view, he is trying to prolong the war to cling to power. Most Israelis rightly blame him for creating the crisis, and they want him out. But if Netanyahu prolongs the war, he can avoid accountability for his disastrous leadership. That is why Netanyahu is ignoring almost everything President Biden and Secretary Blinken are saying. He this week dismissed the hostage deal as delusional and brushed aside U.S. concerns about expanding the ground offensive to southern Gaza. There is a simple question that must be asked. How does it happen that, despite waging an horrific war which has caused massive suffering, despite ignoring the wishes of the President of the United States and the world community, how does it happen that the U.S. Congress is about to send another $10 billion of unrestricted military aid to Israel? No strings attached. It is beyond comprehension to me that Congress would reward Netanyahu even while he ignores everything the President of the United States says. Netanyahu is the leader of the most right-wing government in Israel's history, a man who has dedicated his political career to killing the prospects of a two-state solution. And yet this bill will give him a blank check paid for by the American taxpayer. It is hard to believe, but this is exactly what this bill will do. And what's even harder to understand is that in the midst of this horrendous humanitarian crisis, the legislation before us actually contains a prohibition on helping for UNRWA, the largest UN agency operating in Gaza and the backbone of the humanitarian aid operation. Israel's allegations against the agency are serious, and they are being investigated seriously. But you don't starve 2 million people because of the alleged actions of 12 UNRWA employees. The whole world is watching Netanyahu as he starves hundreds of thousands of children. We cannot be complicit in this atrocity. As long as this bill contains money to fund Netanyahu's war machine and this cruel war, it must be defeated. Thank you very much.
That is it for today. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live every Monday morning at KKRN.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.